All right, everybody, welcome to Dharma Live Online. Happy to be with you this evening. So this evening, and probably for the next quite many weeks now, we're going to begin an exploration of the teachings on mindfulness. Not that we haven't been talking about that the whole time, but we're going to be looking at a body of text, very famous body of text known as the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the teachings of the four foundations of mindfulness. And I think it's safe to say, and I certainly believe, that all of the teachings that you've ever heard on the practice of mindfulness, whether it's insight meditation tradition, or even secular mindfulness, or various forms of MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, or really any MBI, any mindfulness-based intervention, has its root in this Satipatthana. So it's a big deal. And to just sort of pat myself in the back, if I can do that, we started in January. We started with the life of the Buddha, and we've gone through the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and we're on path factor number 7. So I feel pretty good. It's taken me 12 months to really go through 12 topics. We have 4 truths. We have 8 path factors. So we'll see where we begin next year. All right, so where to begin? So mindfulness, this word mindfulness that we have, comes from this word sati, which was translated by a Buddhist scholar, actually a wife and husband, the Rhys Davids, in the late 1800s, around 1881, I believe it was, Rhys David translated sati as mindfulness, and that's how we ended up with the term. Satipatthana, which is where the teachings of mindfulness are located, I just want to talk about that a little bit, because it's a lot different than what you think, I believe. Sati, the word sati really means to remember. So to translate the word remember as mind is kind of a bit odd. It means to remember or to recognize, to recall, a type of ground. So tana, satipatthana, is to remember to recognize the ground. And when the Buddha goes through the four tanas, the four grounds, the four foundations of mindfulness, he's really trying to get us to pay attention to our experience in a way that's very counterintuitive. He's really trying to get us to really, this is where we get this idea of present moment, which is a word you won't hear me use often. I prefer present time awareness. And I don't think it's any surprise to any of you that the practice of mindfulness is largely associated with paying attention to or being aware of or living your life in the present moment. Right? That's usually the first idea we get. Now, the irony of the situation is you can't do anything but that anyway. It's always the present moment. So there's a really strong emphasis on remembering to recognize a kind of ground. And so the ground is the body. He asks us to be grounded in the body, which is why there's so much emphasis on mindfulness of breathing. He asks us to ground our awareness, our remembrance, our recollection, our mind in feeling or feeling tones, hedonic tones, and paying attention to sensory experience that we find to be pleasant or comfortable, things that we like, and also to be aware of things that we find to be unpleasant, uncomfortable, things that we dislike, and also the reality of neither. That sometimes our life's experience is not so much pleasant or unpleasant, it's somewhere in the middle. It's maybe we could call it indifferent. Classically, the mindfulness people call it neutral. Well, I think it's more like neither. It's not pleasure, it's not pain, it's ordinary. Which is largely what life is, I believe, is a very ordinary experience. He asks us to try to be aware of our mental states or the state of the mind. And then, which is mindfulness of citta, which you've probably heard me talk about to some degree, big topic. And then mindfulness of dhammas is the fourth foundation, oftentimes translated poorly as mind objects or mind activities, or sometimes it's translated as phenomena, which I find to be kind of useless. But if we look at the word dhamma or dharma, what is the dharma? The dharma are the teachings. So the Buddha is trying to encourage us to remember the Dharma, to remember that which has been said and done long ago, to remember to recognize, you know, the things that are important to us, the things that we know. So if we kind of turn this upside down for a minute, which I think is actually quite helpful here, the opposite, what is the opposite of mindfulness? It's forgetfulness, right? We forget, you know, and I believe that I live a good portion of my day in an experience that I could easily call forgetfulness. I forget that I'm trying to be a good person in the world. I forget that I'm trying to help others. I forget my core sense of values. I forget the things that are really, really important to me. I forget the things that really, really matter. And I forget a lot of this stuff. And then I get bogged down. I get reactive. I get controlling. I get scared. I get cagey around very, very specific things, like not being able to remember a password to a bank account on my computer. People not doing the things they were supposed to do. People not showing up for things they said they were going to show up for. A whole range of things. I really get very myopic, and I attend to those things in a destructive way. And I develop all these kind of destructive mind states. I get confused. I get angry. I get upset. I get frustrated. I get blaming. I get judgmental. I get critical. I get pointing the finger. I get feeling guilty. I get all these things because I forget my innate sense of goodness, my primary purpose, as the alcoholics would say. You know, what is our primary purpose? Our primary purpose is to remember to recognize that which is important to us. You know, and we forget that. We forget that quite easily. So Satipatthana is really trying to get us to ground our awareness in an experience that is happening now. And so we have to train the mind to do this. The other thing I just want to say, I kind of want to go global on this one, is mindfulness is not this experience that's unique to people who are interested in Buddhism. It's not... it's really an innate human quality. And now modern neuroscience and a lot of the science and contemplative neuroscience around, a lot of the ways in which cognitive science and modern psychology and all these ideas are looking at mindfulness are really pointing this out, that this is just something that you can do, and that there's probably people out there who are experiencing mindfulness all the time. They just don't have that kind of terminology. It's just this basic sense that we have of awareness. We can simply be aware of things. We can have these two qualities, I think, that really encompass them, which I spoke about last week, I believe, is that there's a sense of being present. So I can be present for my body. I can be present for how I feel. I can be present and aware of and cognizant and recognizing of the mental state or the attitude in which I find myself in. And I can be aware of the activities of the mind, the behaviors of thinking, planning, remembering, criticizing, judging, underestimating, expecting, all these different things that happen. That I can really be aware of those experiences. I can remember that that's really where I want to be. Or I can be lost in my thoughts. I could be lost in my mind. And I feel like we kind of rock back and forth. And there are people out there who do this all the time, who don't even know what this word mindfulness is, or they don't know about the Buddha, or they don't care about any of this stuff. So I just want to really kind of put that front and center, that this is not a special Buddhist mind state. Okay. Other traditions talk about things very similar to this. When I lived in Nashville, Tennessee, there's actually a Christian contemplative practice called Christian centering prayer, which is basically mindfulness practice. It's this idea that God can only be acknowledged or felt or known within the present moment. And they sit cross-legged and they bring their attention into their breathing and they try to be present for the experience of God, right? Take with that what you will, but from a technique point of view, it's just a mindfulness practice. So we just have to be clear about this. This is just something that's possible. Now, the Buddha certainly recognized that this was something that was possible, and he built a whole system of mind training around this. So he really took mind science very seriously. And he really developed a first person what we would call empirical science, a first person observation of the mind body process as it comes and goes in the present time, and that this experience of what we call mind is highly observable. Right? This is no small little thing here. This is major. You can observe your mind and the contents of your mind, and you can actually make adjustments moment to moment. You can make attentional adjustments. You can be realizing you're paying attention to this person who did you wrong and what a son of a bitch they are. And next time you see them, you're going to tell them how it is and how dare they and all that. You can pay attention to that all day long. Or you can recognize that that's happening and you can move your attention elsewhere. You can send forgiveness to that person. You can have kindness for yourself. So the mind is highly amendable to change. You can change and alter experience. And it's very trainable. And so people like Richard Davidson, who's really a great mindfulness advocate, he runs the center, what's it called? It's in Madison, Wisconsin. The Center for Healthy Minds is the name of his organization. He's a neuroscientist who studies the effects of meditation from a scientist, neuroscience perspective. And his whole thing is that happiness, and compassion and gratitude and generosity and well-being are all skills that are all trainable. So the mind is neuroplastic, as they say, which means that it's malleable and it's adaptive. And it turns out you can actually teach an old dog new tricks, right? So this is like one of the most encouraging ideas. Is because I oftentimes feel I have trauma and I have addiction and I have a whole bunch of other things. Sometimes I walk around with the attitude that my mind is like this janky contraption that I just kind of got to deal with. You know, my stupid mind, my alcoholic thinking, my tarot, you know, all this way. And that none of that is true. That's just a narrative. That's just a belief system that I don't actually believe, except for when I actually do believe it, which, to be honest with you, is often. And so he sets this out and saying, okay, this is really what is the core idea in Dharma. So if you look at, just to kind of give you some background into kind of where the Buddha is coming from, is that if you look throughout the Pali Canon, if you look at the earliest teachings, and you look at all the ideas that the Buddha formulated, that he developed, that he imagined, and that he taught, some of them were floating around at his time, but there's four teachings that are unique to the Buddha. There are ideas that he developed. The first one, I'll just kind of, we've gone through some of these. The first one, of course, is the Four Noble Truths, that this idea, these four tasks, as I like to call them, and this Eightfold Path, which we've been going through exhaustively, it's original ideas to him. He said, this is how a human being can flourish. He developed that idea. He also developed the idea of causality, or really interdependence, in the teachings of dependent origination, dependent arising, saying that all things that happen in the mind and body, everything that happens in the universe, is dependent upon another condition. I'm not going to get too far into that because that's an elaborate teaching. And for me to do that teaching any justice, I probably would need a dry erase board. He also, mindfulness is the other idea that was developed and taught and expounded by the Buddha. It was his idea, his original idea. Nobody was thinking along these lines at the time. And the other one I think that's also interesting is self-reliance, which goes against the God thing, with the Buddha saying you have to do all the work yourself, that you have to only be an island unto yourself, that your happiness and your freedom and your liberation is dependent upon you, you know, which some people like. I like that. I think that feels good. But then the second half of that we have to forget is that, yes, you're responsible to do all of the work and all of the heavy lifting associated with that, right? So we have this kind of remember to recognize a ground. And so one of the big shifts that he's trying to get us to make, which is spelled out in the teachings, not in Satipatthana, but in other areas that I think is important to acknowledge here, is that what we're trying to do is we're moving from a place to a ground. What does that mean? So, but the Buddha saying is the reason why we're not awake, and really the reason why we suffer, and the reason that we're not flourishing in the present moment, in the presence of our waking life, is because we are preoccupied with a place. Now, a place could be a relationship status. It could be a job. It could be a physical location. It could be, it's you as an individual living in a society, a place, destination, a noun that you want to get to. And we're preoccupied with that. And it happens to me every day. I want to make this amount of money. I want to live in this neighborhood. I want to have this many kids. I want to have this kind of job. We're so preoccupied with destination that we actually, as the Zen folks like to say, what water said the fish? We don't even know that we are not living in the present moment. We're not living our lives because we're imagining a different life that we could be having, a better life that we could be having. We are living in this construction of there's a better moment that we could be in right now. And this ain't it. And if I'd only had done this, and I've only done that, and if I only made better choices, and if only this didn't happen, then my life would be different, and then I would be happy. And he would say that that's why we actually aren't able to see this ground, is because we're kind of preoccupied with this place. I hope that makes sense, and I hope you can probably think of countless examples of how you do this every day. And so, I mean, how hard is it really to imagine a better life that you could be having right now? How hard is it for you to imagine a better moment that you could be in? I wouldn't pat yourself on the back for that one. In fact, that is exactly what we're trying to abandon. That entire tendency. Because what that does is that creates a pathology of lack. My life is lacking. And I think we live in a world, in a culture, in a society that just is like, totally this epidemic of a pathology of lack, you know, of incompleteness, of dissatisfaction, of not enoughness, you know, and we collapse into that, and we don't flourish. We actually, the opposite of flourishing is languishing. We languish and we procrastinate. And we are ambivalent about this. Should I do this or should I do that? Or I don't want to do this or I don't want to do that. Or and then we just kind of fucking check out into carb, sugar, and social news feeds. All of things which I do every day. I'm not trying to say I'm better than this. I'm saying I'm subject to this. This is what we're dealing with. And it's not that we're bad or wrong. This isn't a moral failure or anything like that on our part. This is just kind of the programming. It's cultural programming that we are born into. It's the world that we live in, and it affects us. So I think to even do mindfulness practice, honestly, to sit for 20 minutes by yourself and to try to be with your mind with some degree of tolerance and patience and kindness and friendliness is a very courageous act. You know, imagine this, right? You pull somebody off the street. Random person off the street. You bring him into a room. You give him a chair. You say, okay, come on in here. We'll do a little experiment. What I'd like you to do is I'd like you to just sit in this chair for 30 minutes. Just close your eyes and just pay attention to your body. Just be in your breath. Just sit here, and I'm going to come back and check on you in half an hour and see how you're doing. How do you think most people would handle those 30 minutes? They'd fucking lose their mind. They wouldn't be able to handle it. Maybe not everybody, but I would say a good segment of the population. And this reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from the 17th century French philosopher Blaise Pascal once said, all human misery stems from the fact that we can't sit quietly in a room by ourselves. Think about that for a minute or two. We just, you know, and that's the dukkha aspect of it. That's the dissatisfaction. That's the construction of the mind. Just to be with your mind without any distraction or any stimulation is actually not that easy. And I would go so bold as to say that the ability to, if you can do that, if you can learn how to tolerate and, dare I say, love and appreciate and have gratitude and compassion for your mind, you're basically invincible. Right? Because the mind is the forerunner of all things, as it talks about in the early discourses. Everything is is created in the mind. Right? So the idea, this satipatthana, this basic idea that we have this human capacity, this innate capacity to observe the shit show of the mind and make adjustments moment to moment, make intentional adjustments, make ethical adjustments, attentional adjustments. So one of the ways that Abhidharma, which is the Buddhist manual on Buddhist psychology, which I'm a huge fan of, and I've been studying for about a decade now, talks about the mind as citta. So citta and mind could be seen as synonyms. And it's also oftentimes described that the mind, citta, is an instrument. The mind as an instrument that organizes energy and information and takes in data. In a resonant way, the mind is receiving experience and it's also generating experience. So the mind is like an instrument that you want to learn how to play. And you want to use the mind as an instrument for human flourishing, which is a possible choice, an option, or the mind becomes a tool for destruction, or a tool for languishing, or a tool for poor me, things never go my way. Bad things always happen to me. I'm this person living in this world. This world doesn't make sense to me. This world doesn't understand me. That's another way the mind can become an instrument. And so, what do you want to do here? You know? And so, this is when the Buddha talks about self-reliance, he's saying that this can be done. And he also says many times in early discourses, that I would not ask you to do this if it were not possible. But because it is possible, I ask you to do this. I ask you to try. You know, one of my students, I actually got a chance to go practice in Burma or really any parts of Asia. I've been in Thailand, but I mostly just taught there. One of my students, some of you probably know Andrew Chapman in Nashville. He went to Burma and sat a 10-day retreat at the Mahasi Center. And he said that, you know, like sometimes he'd get tired at night and want to go back to his place to sleep, but they kind of want you to set out the whole schedule. And he said he would leave the hall and the monks would come over, not like in a policing way, but like in an encouragement way. And they say, please, please try, please keep trying. Because they're just over there. They're just like, you can totally do this. There's that spiritual Dharma emotion, Samvega, which is kind of translated as spiritual courage. Is that, you know, that there's a way that we can use these ideas, these practices, and also these deeply well-tested, verified practices. This isn't no woo-woo shit here. This is no magical thinking business. This is none of that. You know, this is an ancient wisdom that is actually being corroborated as we speak in the scientific community. You know, in fact, you can go to university now and study contemplative neuroscience, which is kind of a conversation between Buddhist meditators, Buddhist monks, Buddhist academics, and scientists. One of my first teachers, Steve Armstrong, used to always talk about the power of the observing quality of the mind. The power of the mind to just its ability to observe. So when we practice mindfulness, which is what we'll do here in a few minutes, we're practicing, developing, training this innate muscle, the power of observation, the power of observing the present time experience, observing the body, observing the breathing coming and going, observing feeling unpleasant, recognizing the unpleasant feeling, well wishing, may I be at ease, may I be kind, may I be friendly towards this unpleasant experience, or having the unpleasant experience and going, why am I having an unpleasant experience? I don't want to have a pleasant experience. I signed up for this fucking stupid Dharma Live online course. I'm having an unpleasant experience. It's pain in my body. I got to find another course to be in. These are options. These are different ways that it can go. You know, and so, it's interesting. It's almost even trippy to think about the fact that you can actually watch your mind with your mind. You know, which is, again, the observation, the observing power, the monitoring. The mind can monitor itself. And there's these kind of What is the third one? There's three M's I have in one of my. I have a course actually on this. If you're interested also too in the secular side of this, I do have a course called Mindfulness for Everyone that goes through this stuff exhaustively. The mind can be monitored, meaning you can observe the mind. The mind can be measured. You can measure the experience and recognize, is this harmful? Is this skillful? What's happening in my mind? Do I want to encourage this line of thinking, or do I want to let it go? Which brings us back to the efforts, which we talked about. Do I want to contribute to this destructive mental force in my mind, or do I want to abandon it? It can be measured in that sense of skillful versus unskillful. And it can also be modified. Adjustments can be made. Moment to moment to moment, we can extend, we can resonate with the unpleasantness, we can feel the affective tonality of the pain or of the emotion or the leftover unpleasantness of an argument I had today. I can resonate with that, and then I can say, it's okay, I'm just a human, I'm be kind and be friendly to myself, it's okay that I'm having a hard time. You know, I can be nibbanic, or I can be tanhonic. I can react, or I can be cool. And now we're back to the four tasks. Hopefully you guys are starting to see how connected all this stuff is. And so we want to be nibbanic. Like I always think of that scene in Pulp Fiction where Samuel Jackson is like, we're going to be like three little Fonzies. And what Fonzie like? He's cool. You know that scene at the end? It's so good. It's like we're just trying to really try to cultivate this mind that is present for the conditions and that is at ease, that's non-reactive. Mindfulness is a non-reactive awareness. It's an ethical awareness. It's a sensible awareness. It's a complex, actually, experience. There's lots of things going on in moments of mindfulness, right? And lastly, I'll say this. So, and this is, I think, very, people get confused about this a lot in Buddhist philosophy, is when we think about Buddhist liberation, when we think about, and I don't use this word very much, but I'll use it now, when we think about Buddhist enlightenment or awakening, we somehow can get caught into this idea, and I think this is a big trap, that liberation is somehow breaking out of this mind system and getting access to this like other thing. Enlightened, awake, whatever you want to call it, liberated, that there's actually there's no transcendence here. Okay, the Buddha does not teach transcendence. He teaches transformation. So there's no transcendence beyond the conditions. There's no liberation beyond conditions. There's only liberation within the conditions. So we're trying to create liberation, freedom, whatever word you want to throw at it. There's lots of them. You could use the word recovery. We need to create that within the conditions of our life, within the conditions of the present moment, within the conditions of the body, our feelings, our mental states, our emotions. That freedom happens within these conditions, not on the other side of them. There's no other side of, in the Dharma, there's no other side of the wall. Okay? It just goes on forever. It's an open system. So I hope that you get that. I think that that's a misconception that I try to break in people. And I think it's, if you've read a few books on Buddhism or if you sniffed around a little bit, you start to get into this trap of thinking that we're somehow going to break out of this human condition, which is just not going to happen. Certainly not taught. And so various schools of Buddhist thought might give you that impression. But I warn you against that because I have spent years. Mostly I say that I really actually feel like I'm just kind of a tragic Buddhist failure, you know, like I've just totally barked up every wrong tree that could be barked up and I've gone down every rabbit hole that could have gone down. And mostly my work and my teaching is to try to help you not do that because it's very irritating. So if I can help you evade some of these rabbit holes, it make me very happy. In fact, that's really the main reason I do this. I like the humans. I like you guys, you know? So let's do some practice now.